You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Who wins when archaeologists argue?
What might Time Team find in a First World War trench?
And could archaeology become obsolete?
I'm answering your questions on this episode of the Time Team podcast.
Yes, welcome to the Time Team podcast. Martin Williams, Helen Geek here, and we have some questions to get to, including, yes, could archaeology become obsolete? That question is going to be answered for reasons that you will find out in just a few moments' time. I shall say this, thank you very much for your responses to our episode last week. If you want to go and check that out on YouTube, you can do that as well, because you can see us as well as hear us. And if you are listening for the first time after watching that, and you've never done it before, welcome. We try and sort of unravel the world of archaeology, don't we, on this podcast, and we have some good fun doing it with your help. And that's what this episode is all about, really, getting those questions that you've been wondering about, and Helen can bring you some answers. And you've got Helen's find, haven't you, coming up in a little bit as well.
Yep.
Any little tease as to what you're going to be talking about?
Well, it's relevant to the month, and possibly it's relevant particularly to you, Martin.
Oh, all right. Well, I look forward to that after the first couple of questions, the first of which comes from Pauline. This is Pauline Lyons, who says, "Hello, bodies such as the Amesbury Archer came from far away. Have there been instances of UK-born bodies found in Europe?" I think this is part of our growing obsession on this podcast with understanding the links between what was happening in the UK and what was happening on the continental Europe at the same time, and how much crossover there would have been between the two things. I've not come across the Amesbury Archer, I have to say,
Helen,
so you might need to explain that to me as well.
Yes, the Amesbury Archer was, as the name suggests, it was found, or he was found, in Amesbury in Wiltshire. And he was a Bronze Age burial. His burial included archery equipment, and his bones are quite well preserved, and some analysis was done on them, which suggested that he came from Central Europe, maybe possibly somewhere like Switzerland. I can't quite remember, but he's a well-known, fairly recent excavation of a really interesting, powerful, important Bronze Age person who wasn't born and brought up in Britain.
Got it, right.
And what we usually do is we usually look at DNA, but most particularly isotope analysis to discover that, because your teeth and some of your bones are laid down in childhood, and other parts of your bones, I think like your ribs, are constantly remodeled, so that you take particular bits, a molar, a rib, and you can work out from the isotopes where the bone was laid down. So it's to do with groundwater and so on. The different water signature will give you your teeth from your earliest childhood and your ribs from later on. So that's how it's done.
Yeah. So, and that's evidence then of, in this case of the Amesbury Archer, of somebody who had been living in Europe, coming to the UK. And so what Pauline is wondering is there evidence of the opposite being the case of somebody UK born who found themselves in Europe?
Well, in theory, we should do, because we do know historically about lots of people from what's now the UK moving to Europe. So in my period, in the Anglo-Saxon period, that would be missionaries and pilgrims and soldiers and diplomatic visits. We've heard on the podcast before from Helen Gittos about 6th century Anglo-Saxons serving in the Byzantine army. So that gives a good example of the kind of mechanism by which people from Britain would move to the continent. Some of them would have come back, some of them wouldn't. And could theoretically be excavated in cemeteries in Europe. There's also, rather tantalisingly, an account in an Icelandic saga about English people. And by the time we're talking about there, English people include people with Anglo-Saxon names, but also with Scandinavian names, because there's been a lot of Viking settlement in England. Now, this Icelandic saga tells us about English people leaving the country after the Norman conquest, which you can imagine, you know, might be a moment for a lot of people to leave, and enlisting in the Varangian Guard. That is the Byzantine emperor's personal guard, a bit like the earlier Praetorian Guard. And then being given land of their own, a country of their own, on the Black Sea coast. And from some place name evidence, it's been argued that that plot of land was in the Crimea. Now, Crimea seems to be one of those places that just always attracts settlers and, as a result, is always being fought over. But having said that there is this historical account and that we know of lots of historical accounts, I don't actually know about any archaeological evidence. I don't know about the DNA or the isotope work that would prove that. So I can't point to any specific examples, but I do know people who are working on this. So maybe we should invite them onto the podcast and ask them.
I think that is a very, very good idea. And the list of people that we want to get on this podcast is getting longer and longer and longer. I haven't forgotten those. So, you know, it's gonna happen. Thank you very much for that, Pauline. Really good question. Helen's fine coming in a moment. But first, let's get one more question from Jess here, who says, it seems to me that there's a real move towards leaving relics and other historical items buried in the ground rather than excavating them these days. I understand that geophys and other technical advances have the ability to show us some of what's hidden below the surface, but it isn't everything by any means. Do you think that this trend towards no-dig archaeology is going to make archaeology obsolete? And Jess then says, she says, well, after all, the definition of archaeology is the study of human history and prehistory through the excavation of sites and the analysis of artifacts and other physical remains. So she's basically saying, if you're not digging, you're not really an archaeologist.
Oh. Well, whose definition is that? I would say that archaeology is much broader. You know, it's the study of the physical remains of the human past, full stop. And there are plenty of landscape archaeologists who never excavate at all. And yet they are definitely archaeologists. The other thing I don't really agree with is that we're not excavating much anymore. I mean, I don't know where Jess is writing from, but in Britain, we've got planning regulations that say if you want to build something that's going to destroy archaeology, it has to be recorded first. It has to be replaced with a record. And most of the time, this is done by excavation. So we have actually got a huge amount of excavation going on all the time. And I think where the question...
I suppose that what Jess is doing, maybe, is thinking about what we did at Brannadunum, Roman Fort of Brannadunum at Brancaster, where we were able to do loads and get loads of the information that we were interested in and answer a lot of the questions, or at least get some way to answering the questions that we were looking to answer without having to put a single spade in the ground.
Yes, it's that the balance has shifted. In the old days, the only way of finding out what was under the ground was to dig, and therefore it felt like we dug everything. But we've we've actually carried on excavating just as much as we ever did. It's just that we've done so much more remote sensing. I mean, aerial photographs, the National Trust's programme of geophysics before tree planting, you know, these are covering vast amounts of the countryside and the whole landscapes. And we obviously can't excavate more than a tiny proportion of those landscapes because there's no way of funding the work. But for the work that that can be funded, we're doing masses of it. And I think that I agree with Jess to the extent that if we can make a good case for excavation, even if it's research, if there's a good way of funding it, then we should excavate. I'm not one of those people that say we don't need to anymore. We know enough already. I mean, I certainly don't think that we know enough already. It's back to that old light bulb joke.
Oh, yeah, which I always forget.
How many archaeologists does it take to change a light bulb?
And it's... they're still drawing up a plan.
We don't know. We haven't got enough evidence yet.
Yes. Oh, that was
and
it.
We never will. We never will have enough evidence because everything changes, not just because we have more evidence that we've discovered, but also because we have different ideas. So I agree with you, Jess. We must not stop excavating. But I don't think that we have. And obviously, I'm never going to argue myself out of a job. Archaeology will never be obsolete.
I think you may well be right. I think you're safe. I think your job's safe. Unless the robots are really, really sort of gunning for you, I think you're going to be all right.
And I'm preaching to the converted a bit here.
Well, yes. Yeah, you are. You are a little bit. On a similar subject, really, should we do Helen's find now? Speaking of, your job and how important it is, and how it couldn't be done by anybody, by any old person and any machine. This is the bit of the podcast, by the way, where Helen, in her role, I suppose, as a finds liaison officer, brings an object to your attention that tells an interesting story. And you mentioned earlier that this is vaguely related to me, so I'm all ears. And also, it's got something to do with the month. Well, I mean, it is my birthday in November. So,
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm.
So you're a Scorpio.
Yeah, I don't go in for all of that. I don't know what it means.
It's not about this object isn't about a scorpion. It's okay. About the month of November, which of course is also the month of Movember.
Ah.
And for about 10 years now, people have been growing a moustache during November to raise money for and to raise awareness about men's health. Now, I don't know whether you knew this, Martin, but men apparently die on average 6 years earlier than women, and it's partly because women are more aware of their health and they go to the doctor more quickly and that kind of thing. So Movember is a wonderful thing. And anyway, moustaches at this time of year, when we haven't got that much to laugh at, they always raise a smile. And Tony Robinson did it a while ago. I felt it really suited him, but he did shave it off the minute he got to December. But he raised money and it was good fun. So Martin, you too could have a moustache if you shaved off the rest of your beard.
Yes. Isn't it funny? Before I got a beard, everybody would say, oh, Martin, you need to grow a beard. You need to grow a beard. Oh, that'd be so funny. Oh, you should grow a beard. Wouldn't it be interesting? And then I did grow a beard out of sheer laziness. And give them a month. And they were like, oh, my God, imagine what it would be like if you didn't have a beard. Well, which is it? Come on. Which one do you want? Beard or no beard?
Yeah,
no, people, the beard is staying because... it's easy.
Oh. Well, yes, it's quite. And it's just that people want to, they just want variety all the time. They want novelty. Mm. But anyway, I thought that I would introduce you to one of Britain's oldest razors.
Oh.
And it's a find from, and it's actually only a few miles away from where I used to live in Norfolk before I moved to Suffolk. It's from South Norfolk, and it's a little bronze razor, about 4 inches long, with a sharp cutting edge on both sides, curved outwards. So it's a shape that a lot of people call leaf shaped. I prefer to call pointed oval, with this cutting edge on both sides.
Ah.
It's late Bronze Age. It's about 3,000 years old, so that's, it dates to about 1,000 BC.
Wow.
And it's got this lovely chocolate brown patina that you often get on Bronze Age items. So I have to apologise that yet again it's from East Anglia.
It's from Norfolk. And not everything's about East Anglia. But it turns out
that it is.
Yeah.
I know. I had a look through all of our, we've got about 70 of these on the database now, and I had a look through each one, and this was definitely the prettiest and best preserved. So I don't know why everything from Norfolk is so much better than everywhere else, but never mind.
Well, the evidence is definitely there. If you want to go and see this, by the way, as always, you'll find a link to the Portable Antiquities Scheme entry in the description of this podcast. So go and have a look. Now, to me, if I was to come across this thing without what you've just told me, Helen, I would say, oh, that's got to be an arrowhead, because it's got a very, very sort of sharp, pointy end. Now, why does it need that if it's acting as a razor?
It's a good question. It's just that it doesn't seem to have the right attributes for an arrowhead otherwise. It doesn't look like all the things that are definitely arrowheads. And it's got a cutting edge. It's not just for going into something. The cutting edge is sharp all around the edge. But the thing that you might also think is that bronze is not a very sensible material to use for a razor. And I think that you would be right. I think that a flint flake would be much sharper. And I would have thought that any hair cutting, any nail cutting even, it was all done with flint, I would have thought, throughout the Bronze Age and before. It's only when we get iron as a material that flint is outmoded, really. Flint is such a good material. But that isn't the only weird thing about this. I think it brings up the question of why do men shave at all? Because you've pointed out that it's laziness, it's convenience. You know, I think it quite suits you, but the main reason that most men don't shave does tend to be convenience. But it's never a majority of men, is it? Men throughout history have always been more clean shaven than bearded.
I guess there are some men who struggle to grow a beard, and so they think, well, I'm struggling to grow it, so I will be clean shaven because that looks neater. There are some, I suppose, if you were growing quite a long beard, unless you had scissors or in my case, like a beard trimmer, if you don't have that, it might be quite difficult to keep it looking neat. Whereas using a razor to get it all off might look better. I don't know. I'm just trying to think of some of the modern reasons why people don't have beards.
I'm beginning to think we need a bit of experimental archaeology here. I don't know many people who have tried to shave with a flint, and I think I would like to encourage them. I'd like to know what happens, as long as they can do it safely.
And I will bring the plasters.
Yeah. Yes, well, that's the thing, you see. We talk about people shaving now, and that most men shave, but in the past, men, I think, were mostly they were shaved. They didn't shave themselves, because if you don't have a good mirror and if you don't have a safety razor, it's certainly tricky, and it might also be seen as dangerous. And there was actually a book published in the 1770s called The Art of Learning to Shave Oneself, which suggests that it was unusual and that it was also difficult, and you needed some training to be able to do it safely. But the thing that amazes me is that all through history, most people have shaved their beard off. And you can tell from coins and sculpture and pictures that although sometimes, like famously, the Emperor Hadrian was bearded, and people said that was because he was so keen on the Greeks, who are often bearded. And in the middle of the Roman Empire, the second and third centuries, that was a bit of a fashion to be bearded, because it was being like the emperors. And occasionally Henry III, he had a beard, Edward III had a beard. Occasionally people would copy the king. But it was never, it's difficult, it's dangerous, but it's also very common. So it seems like nobody really knows why men shave, but they just do. And this kind of leads back to your question of how do we know that it's a razor? Well, they look like small, sharp knives. And if we know that men are likely to have shaved and we've got these small sharp knives and we're looking for a function for them, somebody suggested that they were razors. And interestingly, that somebody was someone who'll be familiar to you, Martin, from having seen the film The Dig, because the first person to do any work on these, any proper work on these, was Peggy Piggott, who, of course, is famously was part of the excavation team at Sutton Hoo in 1939. And she's portrayed in the film The Dig as being a kind of teenage beginner, despite the fact that she was 27 at the time of Sutton Hoo. And never mind. And she was already quite eminent. And a few years later, she published this article called The Late Bronze Age Razors of the British Isles. So that was 1946, and we're still using it today. So it's also, I like this object because it's to do with Movember. It's a very pretty object from Norfolk, from where I used to live. And also, it's connected to Peggy Piggott, who I think was an absolute heroine of mine.
Absolutely. Well done, Peggy. And yes, and well done all the men who managed to shave more successfully than me.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time, and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget, so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
This is Matt Rogers from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
Hey, Bowen, it's gift season.
Ugh, stressing me out. Why are the people I love so hard to shop for?
Probably because they only make boring gift guides that are totally uninspired. Except for the guide we made.
In partnership with Marshalls, where premium gifts meet incredible value.
It's giving gifts! With categories like best gifts for the mom whose idea of a sensible walking shoe is a stiletto.
Or best gifts for me that were so thoughtful I really shouldn't have.
Check out the guide on Marshalls.com.
And gift the good stuff at Marshalls.
This is the Time Team Podcast with Martin Williams and Helen Geek, and this week I'm answering your questions.
And there's a very, very good one. One of my favourites, I think, to have come in, because it's just a little bit different. This here is from Wendy Bradford, who says, and this is good, you're going to get the real insight now into a Time Team dig. Have there been any major disagreements on a Time Team dig that have been difficult to resolve or compromise on, particularly between the different disciplines such as geophysics, landscape and trench archaeology? I know that we see some on camera, but it would be interesting to hear if Helen has any particular memories of a dig where this happened. Also, says Wendy, on a normal archaeological dig, how would conflict between disciplines be resolved? I am reminded, Wendy, just before Helen jumps in with her answer to this, I am reminded of something that I heard Time Team creator Tim Taylor talk about a little while ago, about the relationship on Time Team digs between the kind of the production side of it, so the people that are making a TV show, and the archaeologists who are actually doing the dig, and how Tim has always said, it's the archaeologists who lead this. If they think it's not going to work, we can't put another trench in, but the TV people really want it because they think it would be exciting. Ultimately, it's the archaeologists who get the final say as to whether or not that is a go or no go. Although there are sometimes, you know, disagreements about whether that's going to happen or not. But there is that hierarchy that says, no, ultimately, it is the archaeology that wins out. Between archaeologists, though, well, Helen, over to you on that one.
Oh, yes. Well, I sometimes feel that I've got the kind of brain that doesn't remember conflict. I blank it out of my memory.
Well, we should say, we all get on very well. Nobody's having shouting matches here.
Well, there have been. I do remember the fact that there have been some quite... I can remember going around the back of a building with a shed or something with Stuart once to say, I can't bear it anymore. I can't remember what that was about. I do remember rows happening, but I think we've all softened in the years since it started. There are some things that stick in the memory, and one of them is about the issue of metal detecting, because Mick and Phil were around in the days when archaeologists point blank refused a lot of the time to work with metal detectorists. And this was because they felt, and it was quite reasonable in some cases, they felt that the detectorists had very poor ethical standards, because detectorists were doing something entirely different from archaeologists. They were simply finding objects and collecting them. And they, unfortunately, were using archaeological data, and they were taking it out of the ground. And this upset archaeologists, as you can imagine. We've learnt to work with each other now, but I think that the first collaboration, if you like, between detectorists and archaeologists on Time Team was actually my very first Time Team. It was the 1998 Live at Borsey in Norfolk, and we had a lot of conversations, because it was the Live, we had a lot of time to have filmed conversations about that. And we slowly introduced metal detecting, slowly persuaded Mick and Phil that this was a good way of recovering objects, and that those objects could be interesting in themselves and also useful for dating. So we started off with slowly with metal detecting on the spoil heaps, and then eventually the surfaces of trenches and features, always making sure that it was simply a way of locating objects that were then excavated in situ. And I think in the end, we've ended up in quite a good place where we've got expert detectorists and we've got expert archaeologists who can work together. I don't know whether we've got to the point where being a detectorist is just another form of archaeologist, but I think we are close to that point if we're not there already. So that was a way in which we sorted out a potential conflict by compromising, by acknowledging other people's worries and so on. But within a specific project, well, I think that it's really is geophysics and where to put trenches. That is the main source of conflict. And the way that we resolve it tends to be by digging the trench. And then we move the argument on, because we then argue about what the results mean, rather than we're not arguing what the geophysical results mean. We're arguing about what the excavated results mean. And so that kind of extends and dilutes the argument. I don't know, but I don't think we fall out as much as we used to. But having said that, I still think that geophysics gets away with a lot, because if you can't see an anomaly in the magnetometry, I mean, if you can see it on a plan and then you dig a hole and it's not there, what they say is, well, it is there because it was there in the data. The readings don't lie. The readings are data. You can't argue with data. Just because you can't see the anomaly doesn't mean it wasn't there. And I have nothing that I can say against that, because I think actually they're right. But the really annoying thing, and the thing where radar is, I think, really helping, is that magnetometry doesn't have a vertical dimension. So if you can't find it in your trench, the final thing that they say is, oh, the anomaly must have been in the topsoil, and you've just put it on the spoil heap. And it just drives you mad. You can't say anything about that. So you just don't have a leg to stand on. But because you haven't got a leg to stand on, you can't really have an argument. You just have to admit that they were right. But you can do that quietly, perhaps in a small room by yourself, not to their face.
That's it. Just keep your argument in your head until you've worked out a good thing to say. I have this with arguments all the time, where you only think of the correct response about 3 days after they've already got one over on you.
Yes. But to answer the question about how is conflict resolved on a normal site, well, that's by having a site director who's in charge. there has to be somebody with whom the buck stops. For any particular site, somebody has to make the final decision. And that person has got to be confident that they've got all the experience that they need, they've got all the information they need to make that final decision. And then that stops the arguments, because that person is acknowledged by everybody to be in charge. And if that person then grows a beard, obviously we all grow a beard because that is the fashion that, you know.
Yeah, that's it.
It's having somebody in charge. There have been experiments in having nobody in charge, and it just doesn't work.
No, I can't. Why would you even experiment with that? That's it's not going to work, is it? That's a recipe for disaster. Okay, let's thank you very much for that question. Good. I like it because it sort of stirred the pot a little bit.
Yes. Now, it would be interesting to ask this question to every member of Time Team who comes on the podcast and see if they have different memories. Then we can all have a nice big row about it.
Yeah. Be pistols at dawn, wouldn't it? Yeah. it would be a nightmare. Right, let's get on to the final question. And this one comes from Steve. And I wonder, Steve, that maybe this is just, you know, I think, could this be answered with just a simple yes? I think it maybe could. But Steve says this: would Time Team ever consider tackling an archaeological site on the Western Front? I mean, we would, wouldn't we? Yes.
Yeah, I think so. I think, consider, the closest thing we've come to that is a Time Team special, which is where we follow an excavation that's happening anyway, and join in a little bit, but it's not really our excavation. So we did a Time Team special on a lost World War One bunker in Belgium, I think it was. Taking on a site on the Western Front is quite a big decision, because not only is it not in this country, so you've got all the questions of permissions and so on, and all the expensive travel, but also they're quite rich and they're quite specialised sites. But we do know a lot of people who have the experience to do that. There's MOD archaeologists, ex-MOD archaeologists, people like Richard Osgood and Martin Brown and so on, who we could call upon. I can see how we could do it, but it would be a big undertaking, so it would take a lot of thought. But yes, we definitely wouldn't say no.
And there are an awful lot of unexploded shells in that particular area. I've been to the battlefields of the Somme a few times. I think it's really, really interesting. Mm. And there are some where they've recreated them, you know, and you can go and do it. But then there are some areas where they've just left it, and you can still see a vague sort of Stuart Ainsworth lump and bump, where you can yes, follow the line of the trench as it would have gone through. And there are fields and fields of these. That's very interesting. But then what you'll also notice is if you go into a field in that area in the Somme, what you'll often notice is a pile in the corner of the fields, piles, and I mean piles, of shells that they're still to this day when they're ploughing, bringing up out of the soil. And obviously that is a real hazard for farming, but that would be a real hazard for archaeology as well, because every time we found one, we couldn't just chuck it on a pile, I don't think, like the farmers do. We would have to sort it out, because we don't want to blow up.
We certainly don't. And that's another consideration, because a lot of these projects come about because somebody's needing to clear an area of land. So we'd have to be quite careful about sorting out why we want to be there. What is the question we're answering? You can go and observe somebody else's excavation if it's being done in order to clear land for housing or for agriculture or whatever. And that's how a lot of these discoveries are made, with unexpected casualties of the war that are still coming up over 100 years later. But if Time Team goes, we'd need to have a clear research question, and that would have to be done well in advance, talking to historians and archaeologists and finding out what needs to be done. So a lot of the work that's been done at Waterloo, for instance, that various Time Team people like Hilda and so on have been involved in, that there's been really good questions that cannot be answered by looking at the historical records that we need archaeology for. I don't know what those questions are for the Western Front, but there will be somebody who knows.
Thank you very much, Steve, for that question. And thanks to everybody, actually, who's got involved and asked a question that's appeared on this podcast. There are loads coming in. Thank you so much for them. Do keep them coming. And it's really easy to do that. If you're a Time Team member, that's how you sort of get the right, if you like, to ask a question. And not only do you get the right to do that and to get involved in this podcast, you also get loads of other benefits from Time Team. Not only are you supporting the work that we do, supporting the many archaeological digs that we undertake up and down the country and indeed across the world, you also get loads of like behind the scenes bits and bobs, extended versions of the interviews that we do on this podcast. You get those. You get the opportunity to come and dig with us, which is really exciting as well. Loads more besides masterclasses. Oh, the list goes on. Well worth checking out. Even if you just sign up for 1 month to see what it's all about, I don't think you'll be disappointed. Patreon.com/timeteamofficial is where you need to go if you want to become a Time Team member. Click on the chats section to ask a question on a future edition of the podcast. We're going to be back next week, and we're returning with we're kind of going back to a dig that we did in the very, very first series of Time Team, which I think is really great. So this dig goes back to 1994. I think the program actually went out in 1995. And Time Team was investigating the forgotten medieval kingdom of Finlaggan. It's on this remote Scottish island of Islay. And you're going to meet the man who was actually working on that site and has been doing so ever since. He's just written a book on some of the amazing discoveries that he found there. Well worth a listen. That is coming up on this podcast next week.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to hearing all about that too. But until then, thank you very much for your company today, and we will speak to you next week on the Time Team podcast.
Yep, from us. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This holiday season, reach for the one butter that never disappoints, Kerrygold. Made with milk from grass-fed cows on Irish family farms, it's rich, creamy, and perfect for baking. Whether browning butter for cookies or crafting the flakiest pie crust, Kerrygold's high butterfat content makes all the difference in flavor and texture. Holiday treats will taste extraordinary.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.